Clean contact.
I'd hit it again because that shot was a defining moment. And when a defining moment comes along, you define the moment, or the moment defines you.
Hello and welcome to the Golf Practice Podcast. My name is Andy Hayes, and with me for the first time is Dr. Arthur Hoffman. Arthur is the Golf Practice's mindfulness-based mental conditioning coach. Arthur, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Great to be here, Andy.
So I was really looking forward to this because my mental game tends to be a train wreck on the golf course. And if you've listened to our podcast before, I'm very open that I'm just using this for my own selfish interests to help my game. I've got scored free lessons from Jansen and gotten lots of other good things from it. So I'm really, you know, glad we can take this hopefully to the next level.
Fantastic.
So my first question, we'll get into like your background and why you come to the golf practice a little bit later, but I've always had trouble hitting my driver. So I practice my driver a lot, and I go to the driving range, and I hit awesome drives right down the middle. And I play a course that's maybe wide open, and I hit awesome drives right down the middle. But then I go to a course that's a little bit more narrow, and all of a sudden those drives like go in directions I'd never imagined they could go before, and in directions that they would never go on a driving range or on a hole that's got plenty of space. So can you help me?
So it helps that I've seen you, your amazing drives, actually, and never forgotten them last summer at Lake Bluff. So I could really feel that, the sense of that. So I'd have to start by asking you a question to help you.
Sure. Okay.
So when you're standing on the tee box with a narrow fairway, do you know what the sensations are in your body?
When I think about the shot, it's like I know for sure this is going in the woods. And then I like...
Okay. So you know what your thoughts are.
Yep. And then I try to say, oh, I shouldn't be thinking that. So then I try to get some swings without that.
You know, we're sitting here up in the office, there's a bunch of papers on the wall that have all been part of what we've put together during our sessions teaching the kids mindfulness.
Okay.
And up in the top left of that first sheet of paper, there's something called five hindrances to peace of mind. So think of this as five mind states that might be the state of mind that you're in when you're saying, I know this is going to go into the woods.
Okay.
Okay.
And what are the five?
The aversion, craving, restlessness, self-doubt, and what we call torpor or slothlessness, like kind of constriction, like immobility.
Okay, got it. So let me...
And it's all of the mind.
Okay. So aversion would be if I was on the tee thinking, I really don't want to hit this in the woods.
That could be aversion. Or I wish the woods weren't there.
I wish the woods...
Could be an aversion.
Okay. And craving would be, I really want to hit it down the middle.
I really wish I wasn't thinking this.
Okay.
I really wish I didn't have this problem. I wish this was gone.
Okay.
I wish there was another problem that I had.
Sure, okay. Restlessness of mind?
What am I doing? Sort of a bunch of thoughts, like racing of mind would be restlessness of mind.
Okay. So not being very like calm or something. Right?
Not being very your mind running on and on. Lots of narrative.
Okay, gotcha.
Okay.
Self doubt, pretty self explanatory.
Yeah.
I don't think I can do it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And what's sloth torpor? Never even heard that word, but
yeah, torpor is like a state of no energy, a state of. How restless mind, you're thinking, overthinking.
Tough.
Yeah, it's like a feeling of tightness of the mind, like, like I can't think.
Oh.
Almost.
Okay. Gotcha.
Yeah.
So what have What if my is it possible for a mindset to be all of those things?
Absolutely.
Okay. So does that make it easier or harder to?
Well, does one dominate is what I would ask you. If it's all of them, is there one that's dominant for you?
Well, the one that stands out to me the most is self-doubt.
Yeah. Yeah.
And which is weird because I know that's just like the thought that's on the surface, but I know like deep down that I can hit the shot, but
right.
For some reason I doubt it. And
right.
I don't know why I'm doubting it.
Right. So self-doubt is this amazing mind state quality that in golf I think is a huge part of what happens to us. So what I would advise you to do, going back to your initial question, mm-hmm. is when you're standing there on a tee box, and you should probably practice on some narrow situations too, and just stand behind the ball for a couple of minutes before you do your planning, before you do anything else. Just watch your breath and notice what your mind state is.
Okay.
And then notice, where do you feel it in your body? Because you always will. That's one of the principles of all this practice and work, okay. is that there's no separation between our minds mm-hmm. and the rest of our body.
Got it.
It's all interconnected. And so when we're having self-doubt, we have some physical sensations. Mm-hmm. So those physical sensations alter the swing. As does anything like if you had a horrible pain in your left hand, mm-hmm. it would alter your swing. When you have self-doubt and you have tightening somewhere or agitation somewhere in your body, it's no longer a relaxed body when you swing, which is what you need to swing.
So the first step is like realizing that I have self-doubt.
Yeah.
And then try to notice where that self-doubt is. Like that self-doubt is physically manifesting itself
yes.
somewhere.
Yes. And then step three is really, I don't know myself how somebody could accomplish what I'm about to say without doing a lot of formal meditation practice.
Okay.
But I'll say it now anyway, because maybe there's somebody out there listening to the podcast who will say, that's exactly what I do, and I've never meditated a day in my life, and I'd love to add that person to this conversation.
Okay.
It would be so cool, because I know this one way to teach this.
Okay.
But I know there are also, not everybody who's a great golfer meditates, but most people who are great golfers have to come back from the exact kinds of things you're talking about.
Yeah.
And they do it in all sorts of intriguing ways, all of which have certain things in common. One of which is when you see your self-doubt and you see your physical response to the self-doubt, that you have some way through, we teach it through formal practice, some people have it through some God-given gift, I suppose, but you see your way almost to smile at all of that. Almost to say,
now you're speaking my language. All right.
Okay,
smile
cool.
in the midst of the pain and the
yeah. Yeah.
A way of saying like, okay. Right.
Yeah, yeah. It's a way of saying, look at what I'm doing here. Yeah. Whoa. And then just stop. Like I just told the story to Emmy, who was here, yeah. we were talking with before, of a moment I had of this kind of experience that was not on the golf course, mm-hmm. but totally relates to my experience on the golf course. I was once hit by a car. It wasn't going very fast, fortunately, but it was going fast enough to knock me off of my bicycle onto the hood of the car and up into the air. Now, at that moment, I was at an intersection about two blocks from my home, and my wife and my son were right behind me. And as I'm going up in the air from the hood to my apex,
yeah.
I'm like furious. I'm like thinking, who the F is driving this car? They could have killed my son. I'm like so upset. I'm like just agitated. Luckily for me, I think, I had just come back from a nine-day retreat, mindfulness retreat. And when I reached the top point, everything changed because I noticed that I was flying. So it was my moment of letting go of my anger, of my judgment, of my wishing this had never happened, of my fears of what could have happened. They just all dissolved. And I just noticed I'm flying. And I immediately zoned into what to do when you're up in the air in a situation like this from my childhood in athletics. Relax your, let my body relax as much as I can. And I did. And when I hit, roll. And I hit twice. I hit the roof of the car coming down, and then I hit the ground. And I rolled. And I got up and walked away with the only injury being a slight sprain to my ankle. And it wasn't bad enough that I couldn't walk away.
Wow. So you were able to go through all that in like the 1 second.
In a flash.
And you would say that's because of your mindfulness practice?
And the good fortune that this accident happened to happen days after I returned from a nine-day mindfulness retreat.
So,
because I was really deeply in the moment. Wow. And so I returned to the present. And that's really what we always say, right? We always say to hit a good shot, you need to be here for it. You need to not be thinking about it. You just need to be present. And you need to know what you're going to do and then do it. And that's just a sense of presence. Wow. So, yeah, so that's what I think you need to do in that scenario.
Is to be present.
Is to find your way back to where you are, back to the present moment. So when you're there, when you're standing on that crowded fairway, mm-hmm. your mind is all over.
Yeah.
You're not noticing the trees around you. You're not noticing what a beautiful or ugly day it is. You're not noticing anything except all those thoughts about I can't do it.
Got it. So,
I think that's what I would.
I mean, I think you're right.
That's what I say to explore.
I'm so self-aware that maybe you're.
So I'd invite you to explore.
Yeah. So yeah. That I mean, I think what you just explained is maybe the best-selling point I've ever heard for mind, you know, mind of connecting mindfulness to golf or to life, or that like you can be present in that way, but because of like the practice,
right,
that you can't. So you would say it's a lot harder to get to that point of being present on the golf course without like that practice.
Well, certainly it seems like, I think Chris would say that. And this is important to a little bit. I got to interject how I did get here to be doing this.
Well, that's my next question.
Okay. So is it
let's go there. Let's,
is it okay if I just at least introduce that a little to you?
Because
I think it has bearing on the question you just asked. So, you know, I started working with Chris. I forget exactly when, but the first time I ever worked with him was probably 8 or 10 years ago. I had an injury. I was going off to golf with a friend, and I'd had a tear in my meniscus and my knee. And I was working with a PT who knew Chris, and I was trying to figure out how to adjust physically to go and have a golf outing. I'd hardly ever taken any golf lessons in my life at that point. I was a busy doctor for so many years. I'd go out once or twice a year and just hack, you know. I never took the game seriously in that kind of way. And I loved the way Chris taught. He was really engaged and stuff. And so a few years later, when I wanted to start to when I started getting closer to retiring from my medical work, and I wanted to really take up the game of golf and get better at it, I sought out Chris, and I found him. And we started to work together. And after we've been working together, I don't know, maybe a year, he noticed that when I would come back from all the different drills he would give me in practice, that I would talk about my bodily reactions in a different way than other people did. that I noticed what was going on in a sort of particular way. And you'd have to ask Chris what else he noticed that made him think, this fits perfectly with the other poster that's behind us, right? With your plans and the universe's plans for you. And so this idea that the game of golf really just creates all these obstacles to the mind. And so I started telling him about how my physical experience really evolved out of my mindfulness practice. That's one of the things I've learned from my mindfulness practice, is to be fully present in my body when I'm doing things. And I started telling him about the different aspects of that, and he said, this seems perfect. This seems like a perfect fit for what these kids that we teach need. So that's kind of how I got engaged in this. Yeah. So that sort of reflects on the question, which I don't remember precisely the question that you asked, but I think it was
kind of, how does mindfulness relate to golf?
Yeah. So how do they connect? I think that at every moment in golf, there's a lot of time in golf for your mind to get triggered. Mm-hmm. Okay. So
when you say triggered, what do you mean?
Active. So here, let me do it by an exercise first. All okay. Right. Is that cool?
Absolutely.
So just close your eyes for a minute.
Okay.
Do you have any experience meditating?
You know, off and on.
Cool. And what kind of meditation practice have you done? What have you learned to do when you meditate?
Sit upright, breathe, count your breaths.
Okay.
Things like that.
Okay, cool. So instead of counting your breaths, sit upright, close your eyes for a sec. And just make it your intention to observe each breath, and I'll silently count to 10 while you do it, okay? And other people can do this who are listening,
so
too.
You're telling us we're going to close our eyes,
close,
slowly count to 10.
I'm going to count to 10.
Oh.
While I count to 10 to myself, I'm not going to do it out loud.
Okay.
Just observe your breaths, in-breath and out-breath, each one that occurs in this time frame to the best of your ability. Okay?
Okay.
Okay. So that's 10. So did you notice that your mind wandered away from your breath at all?
Mm. No. I felt all right, actually.
Didn't wander away. Okay.
Not too much.
So other people listening, I'll bet some of you had that. Mm-hmm. But if I had you do that for 5 minutes.
Oh, if you had me do that for like 2 more seconds, it would have.
It would have.
Be gone.
Okay. Yeah. So that's what I mean by there's lots of time and around the golf for your mind to wander. Mm-hmm. So there's this principle in mindfulness. It's called the universality of the wandering mind. The human mind is actually built this way. It's built to wander. And I believe this has always been a struggle for our species, Homo sapiens sapiens.
Wandering mind, okay.
Yeah, because 2,500 years ago, this Indian prince named Siddhartha came up with all these practices to work with this wandering of the mind. Because the wandering mind has certain qualities, and I would say it maybe would resonate for people to call the wandering mind an autopilot type of thing. It's not like you try to wander your mind. It just wanders. And if you watch the wanderings, they tend to have certain qualities of judging. And by judging, I don't mean necessarily being harsh, although sometimes they are quite harsh.
But judging can be good or bad.
It's evaluation,
yeah.
Right? It's putting an evaluation on.
Yeah.
The wandering mind is, I wish I hadn't said that, or I wish I could have said something else. This kind of non-acceptance of what's happened in the past. It could be worrying about what's going to happen in the future. It could be getting wrapped up in something that upsets you.
somebody said something, you said something back. It was a difficult interaction. And it, you know how you walk around with that stuff for days at a time sometimes. Sure. So it could be that. It could be impatience. It could be self-doubt or not trusting yourself, not trusting the other, sort of like you said on the golf shot, like having self-doubt. These are the kinds of qualities that that wandering mind can have. It can have others too, but it can have that undermine what I would call our sense of equanimity. And our sense of equanimity is a little what you said, when you said earlier, you mean like just smiling at it and just letting it be okay the way it is in the eye of the storm. So equanimity is actually, that's how it's defined, as being at peace in the eye of the storm. That's kind of what we're teaching the kids.
And so it's not really making, it's not making the storm go away.
That's right. That's right. It's welcoming the storm and being present. The two athletes who I've heard talk most eloquently about this state of mind, neither one of whom learned it from practicing any of the meditations, one is Michael Jordan. So he always used to say, I don't know if you're enough, if you're a student of basketball at all. I know you're not old enough to have watched Michael, right? Or are you?
Yeah, I am.
Oh yeah, oh you are. Okay,
yeah,
cool.
I saw that last. I remember his winning shot in 98.
Okay. Okay, cool. So you remember how Michael used to say, when I get on the court, all that matters is what's between those 90 feet.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay. So it's completely, it's like totally zoned in and present to that 90 feet. And then he would also say, if I'm not feeling it on offense, I play defense and let the offense come to me. Okay?
Yeah, I've heard that before, but I never really. Okay, where are you going with it? Okay, keep going.
Well, so that's a way of being fully present without fighting.
Also, oh, not
what's
like,
going
it's
on.
Not forcing the offense if it's not there.
Right. It's not forcing anything. Yeah. It's just doing. It's just doing. It's just yes. It's just being fully present to the whole game. So the even more eloquent version that I heard of this, and it's in a book, and I could find the reference, and maybe we can, you know, talk about that for you, but it's I think the book is called The Mindful Athlete.
Okay.
And there's a description by Bill Russell. Do you know Bill Russell? There's a description by Bill Russell, and I guess for listeners, Bill Russell was one of the more amazing athletes that I saw as growing up as a kid playing basketball, because at 6'9" he could neutralize Wilt Chamberlain, who was 7'2" and had about 75 pounds on him, and he could play him to a draw. And Bill Russell wrote about, talked about how when he was playing defense, he was so tuned in to what was going on around him that he knew where the ball was going next. He could anticipate it, and he was right. He just knew, because he could see other people's tendencies. He was just such a witness to what was going on. And so imagine having that quality when you're standing over a golf ball, and imagine how many times there are when you're playing around a golf that you have an opportunity to go away, to disappear from the here and the now.
So it's just, going back to it, it's just like being present and not letting the mind wander.
Exactly. Exactly. But it's not not letting it wander.
Oh.
It's not fighting the wandering. And then, but, and still coming back. Right?
I mean, yes, I understand conceptually, but I'm still just like wrapping my head.
I know, me too. It's like really amazing. So like think about it with my example with my car.
Yeah.
If I had tried to make my anger go away, knowing it was no good for me, clearly it was no good for me while I was flying up there to be angry.
Yeah.
If I tried to make it go away,
yeah,
I don't think I would have had a shot of it going away. Okay. Because once you try to start to make it go away, you tighten more and more and more. Mm. Go back to the golf shot with the narrow fairway.
Yeah.
The more I try to hit it straight,
right,
the harder it gets. So I've got to just hit it straight by being here and doing my shot as though those that narrow fairway is just external scenery.
It's just another... It's no different than any other shot,
yeah,
kind of, is the goal.
Same thing we always experience, right? Going over a sand trap. Going over, you know, going over water, a body of water. You know, same thing.
I mean, I know it's not, but it's not like pretending the water isn't there.
Right, correct. That's correct.
That's what it's not, you know, that's probably could be like what it sounds like on the surface is like you're getting somehow in your mind that you're not even on the court. You know, you're not even on the course. You're not even noticing anything. And so you might as well just be in a dark room somewhere, like swinging with your eyes closed. But what, you know, why is it? Can you go a little bit more into that?
Say what you mean by go more into it.
More
I'm not
into
sure
how is it not pretending something doesn't exist that clearly does exist? Like I could hit it into the, you know, I could hit it into the woods. The woods are right there. So how is my, you know, I could see a false interpretation of what mindfulness is. It's just like, well, you're trying to get present in or and like pretend that the woods doesn't exist and pretend it's any old shot.
Yeah.
But the woods are still there.
Right. Well, because I guess I'm not sure. It depends kind of question to me. So it really depends. All of this depends on what's happening within you at the time that you're standing on that tee box. So a lot of times people ask me, well, is it different than visualization? And I think this might be a good example that maybe that would be an example of how to help see the difference between the two things that you just raised. So could you stand on the tee box and visualize the center of the fairway and just practice visualizing your ball going down the center? And I would say a lot of people have had success with that, I think. I mean, it's not a mindfulness approach, but a lot of people have had success for that. And it is an approach that does some of what mindfulness also teaches you to do, which is to zone in and be fully awake to what you're doing, to the actual swinging. The reason we teach mindfulness as this way to work with golf isn't because we know that mindfulness is the best way to do this. It's sort of an ongoing experiment that we're doing. But we see with the kids all the time how they just have these very new experiences by practicing the mindfulness. And many of these kids, all the kids who get to M360 have had a fair amount of golf training, and many of them have had visualization as part of that training. Mm-hmm. And I think they might answer better, some of those kids, how it's different, because I've never personally used visualization. But here's how I see it as different.
Okay.
To me, when you're visualizing, that's part of your plan for your shot. But there's a part before you plan for your shot that has to do with being at peace as you start to plan your shot. And so just getting up and trying to pretend that the woods isn't there, mm-hmm, you'd have to experiment with that and see if that brings you peace.
It doesn't. I've tried.
Yeah. I would have guessed it doesn't. Yeah. So say what it does do to you when you try to do that.
Well, it's like when someone tells you, like, don't think about an elephant.
Yeah.
All you can do is think about an elephant.
Right. So what we do in mindfulness is we just turn zone into the elephant for a moment.
Okay, so think about the woods.
Well, pay attention to the woods.
Okay.
Just notice it's just the woods.
Okay.
Nothing more, nothing less.
It just is something.
Yeah. And you can probably also notice how the woods draws your thinking out.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, how your reaction, your inner reactivity is to the woods. So that's not going to go away. But the mindfulness teaches you how to be okay with the reaction and to let it go and then to hit your shot. So it's really in the preparation before you actually hit your shot. So that's why when you see us work with the M360 kids,
mm-hmm.
they all stand behind the ball for a moment before every shot, and they do a brief meditation. They've done lots of meditation practice to get to where they can do a meditation in a flash. Yeah. But they do a brief meditation, and that meditation is basically the meditation of working with all of those distractions, of all those thoughts, all the self-doubt. It's done in an instant, because you have to do it in an instant in order to hit a golf shot, because you can't stand behind the ball for 5 or 10 minutes and do psychoanalysis or
sounds
meditation. That wouldn't work too well.
So it's basically you're saying, like, there's lots of mindfulness practice outside of golf, so that when you're playing golf, you step up to a shot and you do maybe a couple breaths or whatever it is, and that kind of like brings you into the present.
And I like to talk about that as the practice you do outside is a reshaping of the brain. So this is the sort of, for me, one of the really exciting parts about mindfulness, and one of the things I love the most, is that really this is about how the human brain works. So have you heard of neuroplasticity? Okay.
I never thought, you know, we'd get into neuroplasticity on this podcast, but I'm in. Let's go.
Okay. So neuroplasticity means, sort of in the simplest way, you can teach an old dog new tricks. That the brain continues to have the capacity throughout life to reshape, to be reshaped. So what's really interesting, one of the most exciting ways I've heard this talked about, a number of years ago, I was listening to a webcast. Is that different? I don't know. I'm very untechy in that way. But I was listening to a webcast by a PhD named Richie Davidson from the University of Wisconsin. And he researches mindfulness, and he's been doing it for many years and practicing as well. And Richie started this podcast by saying, you know, what we've learned in neuroscience is that every moment, including this one that we're in right now, our brains are being reshaped, like every instant. So Richie said, so you kind of have a choice. You can let just whatever happens change your brain in whatever willy-nilly way it does, or you can have an influence over it by practicing some kind of brain-shaping activity. And mindfulness is one. So we're really reshaping our brain so that we see our judging. So let's just take one thing that we do a lot of judging. We do a lot of evaluating that gets in the way. Like in golf, it gets in the way so much. Good shot, bad shot, whichever I hit, like I'm like so busy evaluating that, it always gets in the way with the next shot, whether it's good or bad, right?
Yeah.
In some way or another. So we're really good at judging. That's how our brain is built. We're not so good at non-judging. We're not so good at just, oh, isn't that pretty? Isn't that great? Okay, now I'm on to something else. we're not so good at those transitions, it seems. We're built to be, but something about the way we grow up as human beings, and I do think this has been going on forever as human beings, something about growing up human leads us to suppress our non-judging and highlight our judging. And so this is about balancing the two, so you can notice your judging and then let it pass and then take your shot then, rather than taking it while judging.
In a minute. I mean, it's great stuff.
Does it make sense the way I'm saying it, do you think? Is
yeah,
this going to be
so
clear for people?
Thinking, I'm just, you know, I'm going to Florida next month, and I'm thinking about myself on the tee, and I'm, okay, don't, you know, just recognize that, you know, the woods are there, get past it, but then, like, the woods are going to come back.
So, yeah. Yeah.
So is that just, I need, so you, if I do some mindfulness practice, it's going to be easier to do that.
Yes. I would say that if you want, I could sit down with you. When are you going to Florida?
In a month.
So we could sit down sometime and, you know, record a meditation practice to prep for that moment. And you could do it for 30 minutes a day between now and the time you go to Florida. And you'd have a different experience. Like, and I guarantee you it'll be the experience you want. Of course not.
Yeah.
But you'll have a different experience. You'll learn something new about yourself.
Okay. So, I mean, can you sell it to me a little more than that? 30 minutes a day is a long time.
It is. And no. I mean, I can sell it to you as more.
Okay.
Okay? But I'll be engaging in the kind of sales that I really have no interest in.
So
it'll be, all right. You know, there's not a it's really
not a magic
you're
form.
Raising an important point. Yeah. This is not a magic bullet like we're used to. You know, and as a doctor, you know, like I have always been saddened by the degree to which our culture and community really wants a magic bullet for everything.
Yeah,
we're so accustomed to wanting something that comes easy. So I don't know if something that comes easy, could you try it for less and see if it works? Yeah. Do I think less than 30 minutes would work? Who knows? Do I think 45 minutes would be better than 30? I do. That's how I started to practice, was 45 minutes a day, every day. And I was busier then than you are now, I guarantee you. I can tell you how busy I was then, and you'll go, really? And you practice for 45 minutes a day? So I
did you do it all at once?
The 45 minutes? I did. So I had kind of a transformative experience, like one of those moments in life.
Yeah.
So I was out looking for a stress reduction program for my patients at Cook County Hospital. And I came across John Kabat-Zinn and Saki Santarelli, who, and John is the person who created the mindfulness-based stress reduction program that I learned about back in 1990. And like I said, I had a boatload of intense stressors in my life, just a boatload. And I was looking for a course for somebody else's stress. If you'd asked me if I was stressed, I would say, no, I'm excited by my life. It's really great. I mean, I work really hard. I've got a lot of problems. I've got a lot of hard things going on. My dad's ill. He's 1,000 miles away. But my life is wonderful. I'm, like, so happy. But at the same time, after 3 days in a workshop with John and Saki, I felt like I'd been on a 9-month break, a 9-month sabbatical. Mm. I felt so awake and so refreshed. And during the workshop, I was carrying two pagers. This was back in 1990. You didn't have a cell phone. You carried quarters in your pocket. When you got paged, you went out and found a phone.
Sounds terrible.
Well, it's different.
Okay, it's different. Okay. Right. I guess there's good and bad of having a supercomputer in your pocket.
We could go into the complexity podcast. Of all of that, yeah. Couldn't we? Which would be an interesting discussion as well, but not,
maybe for a different podcast.
Not this podcast. Yeah.
Okay, so where were we?
So, I think we were at this point so I had this transformation. It was like, holy Toledo, I want this for my patients. And first of all, one of the things John and Saki always taught right from the get-go was, if you want to learn to teach this to anybody else, and they were offering this workshop to people who were healthcare providers who wanted to teach it to others. They said, if you want to teach it to others, first you got to really get to know it. Well, they didn't need to tell me that after the transformation, because I didn't want it to end. And it was, before that time, every time I would go on a vacation, I would come back from the vacation, I'd be incredibly refreshed. I used to take these long, wonderful, quiet vacations to really, remote places with my best buddy. And we'd do it about once a year, and it'd be 2, maybe 3 weeks. And I'd come back, and for about a month or maybe three, I would be so at ease. After I started this practice, I didn't need those vacations anymore. I still took them sometimes because I love them, but I didn't need them anymore. I didn't have to do it, because what happened after the vacations was about 6 months later, I started waiting for the next vacation. Once I started doing this, it was almost like life had its vacation built right into it. So I was sort of won over, and these guys said 45 minutes is probably the time to practice, and so I did. What I then learned by I don't always practice 45 minutes, okay? But what I know is it's really different to practice 45 minutes than it is 30, and it's really different to practice 15 than it is 30. And what's different is kind of in 15 minutes, I can just sort of be pretending. Even in 30 minutes, I can be pretending I'm turning towards my body and my breath and my mind states. But in 45 minutes, it's hard to pretend for that long. Okay, and so there's a certain shift at some point. Like when I first started doing the practice, I would get up in the morning. First thing in the morning, okay?
Yes.
And I would notice in the first 10 or 15 minutes, so much racing of my mind. It was like 5:30 in the morning. My mind is just racing. And after about 15 minutes, every time, I would start to break into laughter. Because it was sort of like, who thinks that your mind is racing when you first get up? Well, of course it is.
Yeah.
This practice let me quiet down. So that by the time I went to work, I was a different state of mind. It was way more effective. People started noticing it at work. I used to be a kind of angry guy before I did this. I used to have a pretty short fuse.
So just a few things that we need to highlight. You said you weren't trying to engage in selling practices that you don't, but it seems like you went from being an angry guy with a short fuse, then you did mindfulness practice, and you're someone who can be hit by a car and while flying through the air can not be angry and can catch yourself.
Or can get angry and let it go.
Okay.
Right? No, it's the same thing. It's pretty close. Okay. You said catch yourself. It wasn't really catching myself, but it was catching myself. Yeah. But it wasn't catching myself by saying, I got to stop this.
It was just noticing something.
It was just being awake to what was actually happening.
And noticing that was enough to...
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. That's all it took.
Okay.
For me in that moment.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's interesting. I haven't thought about my presentation that way, but yeah, I guess that's a pretty good sales pitch.
And also,
of course, the other thing is to not get hit by a car.
Well, sure. A vacation built into everyday life is also a pretty good. You know, that sounds like a book that you would write.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty good too.
Yeah, you know, John, the first book he wrote was called Full Catastrophe Living, and Full Catastrophe Living is an expression that comes from Zorba the Greek.
Okay.
And Zorba the Greek was dancing on the beach, and his buddy asked him, "Have you ever been married?" And he said, "Yes, the whole full catastrophe." So in a way, yeah, it's like vacationing throughout life.
And so you recommend the 45-minute practice, like, first thing you do? Or that's what you found most helpful for yourself?
I didn't hear the second
part.
Have
you found that most helpful for yourself?
So when I teach mindfulness-based stress reduction to adults, it's an 8-week course, and I always encourage them, and often they get there, sometimes not, to work towards practicing for 45 minutes a day for the 8 weeks and make an assessment for themselves as to whether this is worth their practice time.
Hmm. So you like, try it out.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And do most people see, like, it's worth it?
You know, I don't have statistics that I could answer that question.
Okay.
I think so.
Okay.
I don't think everybody gets to 45 minutes. There's been a lot of discussion about this and different science stuff that's done around this. But I think that everybody who gets to 45 minutes says, yeah, it's different.
So there's something about 45 minutes.
That's different.
It's different.
Yeah, without a doubt.
Wow.
To me. Yeah.
So let's say I want to, or maybe the listeners and I want to start this tomorrow. What would you have us start with?
So if you want to do it on your own without anybody's, without taking a course, there's the book I mentioned, Full Catastrophe Living by John Kabat-Zinn.
Okay.
That's K-A-B-A-T hyphen Zinn. It's kind of a self-help manual. You can a self course. What do you call that?
Self-help
course. Is that the right word for it? I'm not sure.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So that's one thing that people could do.
Teaches you mindfulness?
It basically walks you through a mindfulness-based stress reduction course using the book. The second way that people could do it is they could find an MBSR course. There are a number of them in Chicago. I don't know that we want to advertise names on the podcast. I could tell you the name of a wonderful guy who teaches MBSR.
That's fine. I'm just trying to help people.
Yeah.
So.
His name is Chris Kroniak, and he's a wonderful teacher. He teaches in Chicago. There are other people who teach, too, in the Chicago area. I haven't kept up as much as I used to, so I can't really tell you other people, but Chris is a absolutely wonderful resource.
So you'd say a book or a course.
Yeah,
it's kind of the way.
Those are two simplest ways. And I,
simpler would be like neither of those. Like, is there a way I can start tomorrow? I'm not going to go to the bookstore tonight.
Yeah. There is a way you could. Is there a way you could start tomorrow? So I guess, again, there are many ways. There are many. It's a tough question for me. I gotta sit with this with you for a second. So, if you wanna kind of learn the way I learned this, I would start with an app that you can download on your phone. The app is called, I think it's called JKZ Tapes. Let me just find it for you. Hang on a sec. And yeah, this would be the way you could start tonight. It's called JKZ Series 1, okay. Series 2, and Series 3. Okay. I think they cost $9 a piece or $6 a piece. Series 1 is the 4 recordings that we use in teaching an MBSR course.
Okay.
Series 2 is a series of shorter tapes that introduce all of these things. And Series 3 is some... I don't know what to call Series 3. You'd have to pledge and find out for that one. It's okay. It's beyond the scope of a really brief discussion. Okay. So that would probably be the easiest way to get started. Yeah. Yeah. Thanks for pushing me, because I wouldn't have thought of that.
That when you start to teach, like, our kids, you know, mindfulness.
Yeah.
What do you have them start with? Listening to tapes and sitting and breathe. It tells you kind of like notice your breath, notice, you know, body scan type stuff.
So. We go through what are called the 4 foundations of mindfulness. So every time I teach mindfulness, because I learned from John, this is how I learned to teach it. And the MBSR course in 8 weeks goes through the four foundations of mindfulness. So what are those? The first one is awareness of the body and breath. So we just give people recordings. We make recordings right here, guide the students through them. And the first ones are awareness of your body. And then we incorporate awareness of your body breathing. And then once we've gotten to awareness of the body breathing, we go on to awareness of the mind's activity. And that can be emotions or thoughts or states of mind. And awareness of them doesn't mean trying to change them. It means seeing them. So at first, we practice just coming back to the breath. When every time the mind wanders, coming back to the breath. So we get good at that. And then we start to be able to hold an awareness of, say, our self-doubt when we're on a tee box. Mm-hmm. In our mind, but during a meditation practice. So then we set up recordings for that. And then we set up recordings for being aware of the fact that in any moment there's pleasantness and unpleasantness within our experience. So it's all about experiencing things, and then we experience our connection to the outer world. So those are the 4 foundations, and we help people learn about all of those. And a central element that we haven't mentioned, that I haven't mentioned yet, is we teach them to do that in a way where they are being very firm with themselves while also being very gentle with themselves. And I see that combination of firmness, gentleness as what love actually is. And that's my understanding of all of these practices.
What do you mean this is what love actually is? That'll be the last question.
Okay. So ultimately, so you know, we haven't talked about how did Jon Kabat-Zinn create this program, this MBSR course. So what John did before he created the course is as important, if not more important, than what I've said. So John became expert in Zen Buddhism, yoga, and Korean sword fighting. He did this in about 7 years while he was doing his PhD. <All right. Shoo. laughs> And then once he did that, he realized, geez, there's all these incredible wisdoms in these practices that are all wrapped up in all these religious Eastern contexts that most people in the United States of America and any other Western country don't really care about and aren't going to be interested in. So he set his goal to taking those wisdoms out of the context of all of the rituals of any kind of Buddhist religion. So, wait, remind me of the question we were on, because I want to tie it to that.
What does love have to do with it?
Yeah. So, everything is kind of the answer. So, these practices, their whole orientation is really interconnectedness between living things with a spirit of caring and clarity and compassion. And so really what we're teaching the kids in some ways is to be really the best human being that they can. I believe one of the delightful things about working with the golf practice for me is that I know Peter and Chris believe that, of course, love is everything. You know, if we have these, the joy of doing all this teaching with the kids is all the love we get to give them. And, you know, so the reason I say firmness and gentleness is love is because that's what I came to learn as a parent. I never really understood why as a parent, and I guess as also as a meditator, is that my capacity to care for my patients is super enhanced by my capacity to care for myself. And so, but caring for myself takes a lot of discipline because it's not my inclination. It's not the human inclination, in my opinion. We're very programmed to protect others. That's how you survive as a species. You don't let your kid get killed.
Yeah.
You don't let your reproducing spouse get killed, right? Mm-hmm. It's like how we're built. And so we're not as built to care for ourselves. And yet it turns out that that's this very powerful human capacity. And I don't know what to call it other than love.
Well, okay. Well, Arthur, we're out of time.
Cool.
I think that's a great place to end.
Thanks
for being here.
This is a lot of fun. Thanks,
we're going to have
Andy.
To do this again because I have a whole page of questions and I didn't even get to them. So.
Sounds good to me. I can't wait to see what this sounds like on the podcast.
All right. We'll talk to you later.
This is great, man.
Clean contact.
I'd hit it again because that shot was a defining moment. And when a defining moment comes along, you define the moment.